Just a quick note to say that in today's episode, we had a bit of a tech issue with the audio from my side in the interview, and therefore I'm not going to sound as crisp as usual. There's a slight kind of mumbly sort of effect that we're all familiar from Zoom, because we needed to use the backup recording, which is the Zoom audio, versus my proper usual mic. But I wanted to give you the warning and, you know, persevere. There's a lot of value in this episode. There's, you know, one or two things I think I said that were very valuable. And it's just a little frustrating that they might be a bit more. But that was me acting out than being mumbly. So that's all to say for now. Enjoy the episode.
This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about hope as a factor in mental health. And this is a theme that I can't quite believe we've not covered before, because it's hopefully something that we sew into the fabric of the show. And I'm really thrilled with the guest I got to chat to for this one. Kimmy Culp is a producer who's worked in all kinds of areas of the media, including for NBC, ABC, and the Oprah Winfrey Show, which, fun parallel here, you know, fun kind of vague connection, this here podcast has been featured twice by the Oprah magazine. So I got to tell Kimmy about that before recording. And we had such a wonderful conversation where we reflected on how much of Kimmy's career has been uplifting other people's stories. And so, very in-depth conversation, one that I found so uplifting to hear about. And Kimmy has such a strength of character, such a perseverance, and is someone that hope was the obvious theme when her team got in touch. I was like, of course this is the theme. So I'm looking forward to sharing it with you. And I'd really recommend checking out her podcast, All the Wiser, where she interviews guests about a whole load of things, including how they find hope. And for every episode, she donates $2,000 to a nonprofit making a difference in the world to kind of pay forward some of the positivity she finds in life. So a lot to get into here. Also, something I have to mention with this one, I found our post-show chat so great, so uplifting, so fun, so, you know, connected. And if you haven't ever before, this might be the one to give a try to our premium service. So it's called Full Access, and it's exclusively available via Apple Podcasts, if you're listening there, where for a small fee every month, you get extended ad-free episodes. And that means you get to hear my debrief with the guests after the show, where we get to reflect on the experience of sharing publicly in this way. And, you know, it's an opportunity to kind of dive it to a different layer. And I find it really fascinating. And I personally think this is a particularly great post-show chat and maybe a little treat for yourself, because we have an offer where you can get a month's free if you want to try out the expanded version of the podcast and skip the ads at the same time, if that appeals to you. So yeah, that's an option that's there. It should be just at the top of the page for this podcast or our other one on Apple Podcasts. And now that I've mentioned that, thank you for listening. I'm recording this at the start of December, so I don't yet know when in January it's coming out, but I hope your January is going well. I hope the shortness of the days isn't haunting you too much. I know every year I get surprised by how early it gets dark, and then think to myself, I'm sure I was surprised by this last year. But it's nice to think ahead and know that you're listening in January, and so we'll be noticing the days getting longer before long. So keep looking after yourselves and those around you, and enjoy this interview in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Kimmy Culp, and my first glimpses experiencing mental health in the world, it would be watching my father, who was a really successful young businessman and entrepreneur, but there was a mystery around his emotional wellness, I think would be the word that I would use now. I certainly wouldn't have had that language growing up. I just remember periods of him sort of living in darkness, right? Being and his bedroom sort of tucked away, juxtaposed to this very vibrant, smart, insanely hardworking, you know, workaholic. It was a bit of a mystery because I think my mom and perhaps both my mom and dad together protected us from it, from a sense. I knew it was happening, but I wasn't standing close to the fire, if that makes sense. So there was a mental story unfolding in our house. At the time, nobody had language. Nobody had a diagnosis. So I imagine they were really confused. So it wasn't that there was a lot of chaos or instability around it. It was more of just an observation and awareness. This mysterious dance between this two different versions of this really incredible man and father that would later become clear to him once he was diagnosed. And then it would also become clear to me because I am living with that same diagnosis in reality now as an adult. So,
yeah, no, that's so interesting. Thank you for that. And as you came into your own career, I'm aware that you started very young. And were there any parallels there in terms of the workaholic side of things?
Yes. You know, I've often said that my experience of the hypomania, the mania side of living with bipolar disorder, can feel like a constant shot of adrenaline. And at times that is almost exciting to be on that ride, right? Because it's filled with ideas and energy and adrenaline, all of those things. And I, consciously or not, chose a career path where that relentless workaholism, nonstop, go-go, don't sleep, hop on planes was rewarded and celebrated. So I absolutely lived, I think, most of my 20s as a workaholic, fueled by a lot of mania at times. And it served me well professionally because I was in an industry that required that level and that pace of energy and work. And I was really good at doing it with little sleep.
Well, that's something I relate to a lot myself as well. Like, I've definitely been there with the workaholism, and I've seen, you know, my own patterns of to what extent am I going to go with turning into my parents in that regard, that I kind of grew up with work being so the kind of center of your life and such a thing that you find purpose from. And a lot of that has given me kind of great structure, including at times when my mental health has been real turbulent. And for you, you had, you know, so much happening in your career. And like you say, kind of racing all over the world, pursuing stories and uplifting other people's experiences. And then alongside that, am I right in thinking fairly early on, you had your own diagnosis of bipolar?
Yeah. I was diagnosed in college, so I was 19 when I was diagnosed, and I really quickly went to figuring out medication. At the time that I was diagnosed, I, for lack of better language at the time, thought I was going to be mad or crazy. I mean, I think that my body and mind felt completely out of control, and I had no real hope that I would get my mind back. So I think I thought I was potentially facing a future in which I lived in a mind and body that were completely out of my control and frankly didn't feel safe or at ease to live in. So it was a terrifying experience. I was emaciated. I was rail thin and not sleeping, and things like cars passing or fountains would startle me. So I sort of went from being this all-American, you know, college kid having a great time, you know, in the beautiful mountains of Colorado, to thinking that I was going to be in a mental institution. I had no idea what my reality was, but I was terrified. And there was no peace within my body or skin during that time at all whatsoever. And I didn't understand, you know, the shelf life of that or how long I could sustain living that way. But I was really lucky and fortunate to have parents who took it responsibly. And they took it responsibly because my dad had just had his mental health diagnosis. So they had been walking this journey as 50-year-old adults trying to figure out the mystery of his mental health and finally gotten an answer and a diagnosis that made sense and then seen medication and treatment work. So the timing of our generational story of mental health, I deeply benefited from. So because of that, I was able to get on medication, get therapy. That semester, I dropped all my classes. But, you know, within a year, I was back taking all my classes, taking my medication, and back to living a pretty full life. The only difference is I was living now with a secret that I had a mental illness. At the time, there was a massive amount of stigma around a label like bipolar disorder. So I did everything I could to hide it. And then I would say during my 20s, I didn't have the skills in self-care to understand kind of how dangerous it is to live in a workaholic, you know, pretty much full-time mild mania or, you know, mild hypomania existence. But somehow I did it, and I did it, and to your point, in an industry and career that rewarded it. So it was almost, you know, just created the reward loop, if that makes sense.
No, I understand that. And I can understand the appeal of that when you get a diagnosis you don't yet understand, one that is still very stigmatized. And you can feel that kind of sensation of the walls closing in of what will my future be now? And then if you see that glimmer of, oh, maybe there's a way in which I can lean into elements of this that might benefit my career, you know, you would do. I can definitely see that path. And would you mind sharing a little bit of the contrast of what it was to experience bipolar before the diagnosis, before you had any idea that's what was going on for you?
I mean, I just remember literally being terrified, going on these long, never-ending runs for miles and miles and miles. And I don't know how to explain it other than it was like I was living in a world that felt like it was a world that I understood, that it was a world that was safe and made sense to me. And almost within the flip of the switch, everything around me and inside me felt chaotic and unfamiliar and unsafe. And that was, you know, during that stretch before the diagnosis, just this overwhelmingly scary feeling to live in a body in a world that suddenly felt unfamiliar. I mean, I think there's certainly, going back in hindsight, I can put a lot of pieces together pre that episode where I got my diagnosis, where I realized that my, you know, emotional regulation or my reaction to things, those were, you know, probably early signs or symptoms of bipolar disorder. So yeah, it's hard to explain. And then even, you know, like you said, post-medication, I don't think, you know, I think my 20s was really still mostly a dance with this chemical imbalance in my brain. And partly, as you said, leaning into the creativity and the adrenaline and the energy and like exploiting it in a way, but then also dealing with the consequences of that, right? And then all of the work of hiding it on all ends.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent through those years were you able to navigate the pressures of your role alongside hiding this condition? And, you know, there's so often side effects with medication. And I understand that bipolar is one where so often reviewing the medication as you go along is an important part of the process, but also can have huge impacts on you day to day as you adjust to different medication.
I think that early 20-something sort of whirlwind post-diagnosis career, exciting, fun time in a sense. As you said, I was working in television and traveling, but it was exhausting. I mean, I would be flying, sleeping in hotels. I would go through just these cycles of crying for hours, like putting ice packs under my eyes, getting on a plane, going to cover a story. But then that night, I could be at a dinner table on the most charming, you know, person at the table with a million ideas. And then, you know, most likely, you know, having four glasses of wine to just quiet the voices in my head and the exhaustion and just to dim the lights because I was so exhausted and confused and tired. And then I could just do that whole thing on repeat for weeks and months. And yeah, at the same time, balanced with, I always want to be careful not to portray it as so chaotic and dark, because there was also room for meaning and connection and wonderful, interesting, creative opportunities. And, you know, I was with my husband, who I'm still married to today. We have three kids. So, you know, there was good in that period, but certainly a lot of, I think, living with a fair amount of mania channeled into work and my identity around that.
And to give our listeners a bit of a kind of idea of like the pressure and the high-paced environment, I remember you sharing a story about what it was like to work on the day of 9/11. Would you mind sharing a bit of that day with us?
Yeah. So we were living in Washington, D.C. I was newly married. I was working at NBC News Washington, which at the time, you know, was one of sort of the three major news networks in the country. And my job happened to be the researcher for the aviation and transportation beat. So anything having to do with essentially airplanes or air travel was in my domain at the network. So obviously, when planes start crashing into the World Trade Center, the first blip was that, you know, it was a commuter plane. And I just remember my husband running. I was in the shower and saying, you need to go into the office right now. But I think I left the house that morning, and it would be, you know, obviously living in Washington, D.C. and working in news when your job is, you know, standing witness and reporting what's happening, it would be days and weeks and weeks and weeks of really living in that newsroom reporting. And so much of it was we would sit in the editing bays, these dark editing bays in the basement of the newsroom, watching all of the footage to figure out what footage we would isolate to, you know, distribute, to stream out, to tell these stories. So hours and hours and hours of, you know, the interviews of people mourning, of people jumping. I mean, it was such a dark time, certainly for the world, but we were living in it through this very unique experience of all of it, you know, just sort of coming in and being filtered through, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that's one of the most difficult parts to wrap your head around if you're not within that industry, is how when events like that happen, that have such a kind of global impact and can really shake people, that becomes some of the biggest defining parts of your career. So the very thing that's so horrific to kind of go through as an American is also the thing that becomes such a thing that you're known for covering.
Everybody's job that day, I went from being a young researcher up, because it was obviously all hands on deck. And the people, you were obviously standing witness to history, tragedy and violence and loss and suffering and on steroids, but just even the stream of people who had lost their loved ones, or politicians or first responders just walking in the room, sitting down, telling their story. This, the videos coming in, us going out. You know, we were in Washington, D.C. There was the Pentagon crash. So it was very heightened and very immersive. And yeah, we had a real responsibility to tell the stories through the eyes of the people who had lived and experienced. And it was very intimate and very intense and very important. And I was really young and just sort of thrown into it.
And when you describe this contrast of this massive career and then also your attempts to kind of almost detox from some of the harsh realities of it, you know, to go home and try and figure out how do I turn my brain off from some of this stuff.
Yeah.
It does, you know, sound like there's parallels there with your father. Did you find that that helped you kind of understand, you know, your own experience, but also his?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's been a wonderful mentor to me. And as I've gotten older, I've realized how lucky I am and how much value there is, and to have someone who I love and trust, and, you know, to look back on his experience and say, you know, I wish I would have done this differently, or I wish I would have been more thoughtful about balancing my mental health and my professional career. So, I mean, I don't think now where I am in my life, I definitely know that I have benefited from his learned experience at times, but I think early on in my career, I don't think I had a ton of self-awareness about any of it. Mm-hmm. I think I thought that I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. I mean, this was the career that I had dreamed of, and I was living it, and I was doing, you know, pretty well at creating opportunities for myself and working really hard. But I didn't get then that there was a cost involved.
Mm-hmm. I would go as far as to say maybe, you know, there's something typical in that for a lot of people's experiences of bipolar. There might not be the exact parallels career-wise, but I think something of that experience of mania can be a losing touch with reality and with a certain amount of prioritizing, because you're in that place which is both can be hyper-focused and, you know, very overstimulating, but then also kind of detached at the same time, which is, you know, I think unless you've experienced it, a very difficult thing for a lot of people to get their head around.
It's so hard to explain. I wish we could all just be like portals into each other, right? You could be like, okay, we'll just spend an hour and then it'll make sense to you. But yeah, you know, I've talked about it before, and I'm sure you've had these conversations many times, but there's a lot of beauty to be had and experiences that I have had during some of those more hypomania, manic phases that I don't have regret or shame. I understand their relationship to that piece of the chemistry of my brain, but I think the experiences themselves were meaningful and created and things in the world that I'm proud of and that I hope and believe have value. So it's sort of hard to untangle it all, if that makes sense.
Oh, it definitely does. Yeah, I think that's so well articulated. And it's a tricky thing to describe because you never want to glamorize experiences that were objectively so difficult. And yet, as we work on our mental health, there can be something beautiful about gaining that perspective of, isn't it fascinating the ways in which my brain works and the ways in which on one day to another, I can see a situation completely differently, depending on my mood and kind of my level of mental ill health at that point. And, you know, with therapy, with medication, with other support, I think we can get that distance to find that beauty versus treading water with it.
Yeah, and I think it's like also this idea that it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be and, right? Like, you know, looking back, perhaps there was some darkness woven in. I was living, you know, with too little sleep, too much anxiety, self-medicating. There was periods of deep connection and meaning and empathy and contribution and creativity or art or production or experience or travel. Like, it's honoring all of it, right? It's actually all true, right? And so honoring all of it, as opposed to saying, well, because this was potentially rooted in some pieces of my mental health that are complex or confusing or can be dark at times, doesn't negate any of the good that came out of the experience or, you know, the process or the product.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. I feel very much the same, where I think that's a really lovely part of working through stigma, is finding ways that you can accept this is something that's been a part of my life and a part of me. And would I change it now? At the time when you're in the depths of it, you want anything but to be feeling how you're feeling. And you wouldn't want to necessarily go back there either. But there can be something in working through a lot of the stigma around it that you can look back on the experiences and be like, well, that was a part of my journey. And, you know, my life would have been different without these experiences. And maybe I wouldn't have met certain people. Maybe I wouldn't have got certain support that, yes, helped me mental health-wise, but also enriched my life in other ways. You know, like I believe, for example, therapy should be for everyone. Like if it was up to me, it would be something that when you're born, the state assigns you a year or two just by default. And that could then be encouraged to be a, well, I've got to use it. You know, I don't want to waste the thing that I've got. You know? I mean, that's the first time I ever got therapy was that was, it was part of a like well-being package at a workplace. And I was like, well, I might as well, you know, take the company for every penny they have and make the most of it, you know. And
got a free Starbucks card. You got to get a coffee.
Exactly. That's how I was kind of rationalizing it at the time. And I think, you know, it's exciting to be edging towards a world where we're kind of seeing a lot of their support methods in that way. It's like, well, we might as well give it a shot and each of us can find benefit. And, you know, whilst you were figuring out the right support for yourself and also navigating your career, all this time you weren't open about the diagnosis. Would you mind sharing to what extent did stigma play a part?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the media's portrayal specific to bipolar disorder and this central casting of somebody who's, you know, unhinged, unpredictable, unreliable, unwell. And why would anybody want to raise their hand and, you know, invite in all of those descriptives, knowing you have little control of how people are going to, or you're going to have the time or opportunity to educate them that you can be living with this illness and be a
kind of conventional,
loving, kind, stable, contributing, dependable, normal human being, normal, quote unquote, normal, whatever that is. So the idea that I couldn't control how other people experienced me and the connotation and the relationship with the diagnosis I had was so heavy and negative, it felt entirely too raw, exposed, unsafe, and vulnerable to share that piece of myself. I did everything I possibly, I mean, I would go on girls' trips and I would like take the medication, put it in the Ziploc, put it in the site. I mean, it was down to like, oh, they're going to see I have all these medications and somebody's going to Google I have the medication and then bipolar is going to pop up. I mean, almost like a paranoid obsession with people hearing that I was living with this illness. And even the words mental illness, right? For me, the weight I was giving those words, a ton of shame that led to a ton of secrecy, which, as we know, is a real beast to live with. You know, you're also managing your mental health on top of that. And then now you're managing shame and secrecy.
Yeah.
Related to that. Terrified what people would think of. I thought people wouldn't want to work with me. I thought there was people who wouldn't want to be friends with me. I thought people would talk about me. And to be honest, since I have shared, maybe some of that is true. I don't know. I mean, people generally don't call you and tell you when they're talking about you or don't want to work with you.
Yeah, it's true. And it's great to hear you kind of be able to make jokes about it and embrace it so openly now, because I can totally understand your perspective on that. And it is such a trap still. You know, that the stigma is still so present that the way you described it there, it was like you had two losing choices, that you're either open about it and many people will just see it as a defining thing about you and very much kind of potentially write you off or think all kinds of horrible things informed by stigma and ignorance, or you kind of open up and you try and educate, you try and take on the weight of this misconception that can exist around so many mental health conditions. And then what? It's such a giant kind of hill to climb. And then you still potentially get, oh, congratulations, your reward is you're still defined by it because you're now the mental health girl. Now this is what everyone expects you to talk about because that's what you have to talk about all the time in order to make any dent on the stigma. And, you know, so I can really understand, you know, where you were coming from on this. And am I right in thinking that ultimately it got to a point where so much of your work had been defined by uplifting other people's stories and finding kind of their hope and what really drives them, that then there was a certain kind of irony itching at you of, I expect people to be so open with me and I see the power of that. You know, maybe
that pile is set for me as well.
Yes. I mean, so, you know, on the podcast, I'm talking to people who have endured incredible suffering. And, you know, the stories we share on the podcast require an incredible amount of bravery and honesty and vulnerability in the sharing. And it just sort of dawned on me, like, okay, here my job is asking people to have really hard, truthful, brave conversations to make meaning out of the messiest, hardest parts of their life, sort of in service to others, and that I am not willing, you know, to do the very thing that I'm asking people to do, which is to talk about my hard parts, my messy parts. So when that became clear to me, I was like, if I'm going to continue to do this thing of telling stories and asking people to have brave, hard conversations, I'm either going to join them or I'm going to stop asking people to do it. So that was the joining piece that you just nodded to. The gift and liberation that have come with sharing, I mean, it changed my life. Yes, it's still hard not knowing how people are going to experience this piece of me, but and just putting it into the light, it's a lot less to bear. I feel a lot less alone. And yeah, there was a certain amount of ease I have around even saying the words that I didn't when I was so desperately spending my hours hiding, you know, the illness and the diagnosis and the fact that I was living with it.
That's so great to hear. And I think there can be such an experience of, you know, inviting people in when you share in that way, that you not talked about this for something like 24 years since diagnosis. And then you're sharing this piece of yourself that, you know, people can connect to. You know, yes, there can be misunderstanding, but there can also be the opportunity for that to change and for people to, you know, connect with you in a different way where they can, you know, understand where you're coming from and maybe even notice things. You know, I know that something we have in common is difficulties around memory that relates to mental ill health. And, you know, that's something that I'm still learning to share with people, because whilst I talk about it and I feel a certain need to kind of insert it as a disclaimer at times that I have memory issues, I'm so used to masking it that even people that know me really well can always kind of connect how present that is something I deal with, because I'm so used to not correcting them when they tell me a story and the story sounds new to me, even though it's the story about me.
Yeah.
And would you mind sharing a bit of what that's been like, kind of not just talking about it, but kind of being able to experience your mental health in a way that's more open and, you know, have other people join you on the journey of figuring it out?
Yeah. It's allowed me, I think, to have more self-awareness. You know, maybe because I'm not so busy worrying about hiding, you know, the work that it takes to hide it, I have more space for almost awareness around it, like even more aware of like, okay, maybe I'm having these bursts of creativities and ideas and productivity and adrenaline, but do I need to lob that into other people's space, right? It's their weekend. So there's become, I think, more self-awareness in like my working relationships and creative collaborations, and that I can even give like language to that. And I like to believe like I'm a lighthearted person. I like to laugh. I love funny people. And so often I'll kind of like wrap in humor, like honesty and levity and awareness and all of these things that are really, it's just sort of like living with it out in the open in a real way. And that's refreshing. And I think it makes for better relationships.
For sure.
Everything is so much more transparent.
I love that. And something that really moved me when I listened to you sharing for the first time about this diagnosis on your podcast was when you talked about, you know, looking back at being 19 and getting the diagnosis and this kind of haunting question of why am I like this? Why am I kind of going through this level of emotional intensity when in so many external ways, my life looks like it's going really well. Like I'm at college, I'm pursuing my dream career, and yet this is how I feel. And you talked about the sort of shame you felt there. Have you been able to work through that now? And what's that process been like?
I think it's confusing when the circumstances of your life are going well, right? You have loving relationships, you have financial security, you have healthy children. So I've always had a hard time reconciling all of that together, right? So if I feel that I have all of these things to be incredibly grateful for, all of these these things that feel like a blessing and a privilege, and how fortunate and lucky am I, and yet I'm still living with some version of, you know, darkness or suffering or emotional sort of torment. Now, I know intellectually that we're talking about the chemical imbalance of a brain, which has absolutely nothing to do with the circumstances of a life, but that disparity can still be confusing for me.
Yeah, it can be very natural.
It's like you feel guilty. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You feel guilty. It's that you're kind of squandering somehow the good things in your life because you're not being grateful enough for them.
And, yes, correct.
You know, it's like you said earlier that both things can be true. You can be grateful for things, but also be in a place where you need help and support. And that need is not to the detriment of your character.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one I continue to work on a little bit.
Mm-hmm. As we start to kind of wrap up the conversation, we talk about hope. Is that something you've been able to kind of partly find through empowering others to share your story? To what extent have you found, okay, this is what it looks like when people live authentically themselves and find out their truth? You know, can I access that too?
I'm so glad you asked this question. I was listening to, do you listen to Glennon Doyle's podcast or her work at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. She was having a conversation. There goes the memory. I'm not going to remember. She was having a conversation. I think it was Gina Davis. But one of them said something along the lines of, like, as an adult, creating something that didn't exist in the world that your younger self could have desperately needed, that really clicked. Because when I realized that when I was diagnosed, had I looked around and seen somebody raising their hand saying, oh, I have this illness, and you know what? I have a meaningful life, and I have purposeful work, and I have loving relationships, and I am honest about this thing, that would have been really hopeful to me, really hopeful, really comforting to me, probably really comforting to my parents, the only people who knew about my future, because I'm sure they were concerned about what my future may or may not look like. So I would like to paint a more hopeful, optimistic option in reality of what life living with this illness can look like. I am hopeful.
That's so good. And one of the ways that I've heard you, you know, talk about that and share this hope is in examining the upsides of bipolar. Yeah. It's so often, you know, our bias, or maybe it's just a human thing, the threat detection, we can look for the negative so often. Could you share a few of the kind of positives you found through these experiences?
You know, I've worked in television and films and books and podcasting. As we said, it's all like tangled together. I think much of my work has been driven by, like all of our work, the unique chemistry of the brain. But for me in particular, the pieces that are associated with bipolar, I think, are very much woven into my work. So much of my work, I'm proud of. I'm grateful for it. The people that I have been able to meet, to collaborate, to connect. You, I'm having a conversation with you in Dublin, you know, on a Tuesday because of being open about my mental health. So it's so important that that doesn't get lost on me, because I do feel like there's some real gifts with a brain that is this active. And I also think that I'm a deeply, deeply empathetic person. And that can be hard at times, but I think I like to believe it's a gift. And I think that's tied to my journey and my experience of living with this illness has allowed me to be a really empathetic and compassionate person. So all of those, I do see them, you know, at the end as positives.
Yeah, and I'm definitely biased towards thinking empathy is a gift because, you know, it's something I've worked hard to be better at. And yeah, experiencing mental health has definitely been a part of that, of saying, okay, this is, you know, knowing firsthand what people can be going through behind the scenes, behind their mask, behind, you know, the time it takes to feel open, you know, sharing what we're already going through. And one last thing I want to ask you about is what this has been like in terms of reprioritizing, because I've heard you share so openly how you've had to at times re-examine the workaholism and the detriment that can have on your family. And so have you found kind of working on your mental health then gave you the space to reframe, okay, where are my priorities?
Yeah, I think it's a work in progress. And I think I've gotten better and better as the years have gone by. And I'll probably like have to always keep myself in check in that regard. But I do feel proud of myself and that I think I have been able to have self-awareness around it, and I've been able to make decisions about what I take on and what I don't take on and how I work and where I work that are much more centered in, driven by, and aligned with my values and prioritizing my people and my family first versus letting, you know, the creativity or the mania or the productivity drive the show. I'm always going to be somebody who's going to have to exert that energy and channel it into those things. In the end, my, you know, my values are always really present and I'm keeping them right there and eyelined to keep me honest.
Mm-hmm. And given that we started the conversation talking about your parents and how big a part they were in, you know, helping get you the support and the diagnosis, how do you feel you'd be now if one of your children was to have a diagnosis like this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that I am woefully, if that's the right word, prepared. If anyone is to help support and love anybody through a diagnosis, and to your point, with a true sense of hope that, you know, living with a mental illness does not come at the cost of living a, you know, meaningful life and contributing. And so I don't ever want to be afraid of it for myself or for anyone else, including my kids.
Yeah, I love that. And it's so lovely to hear, you know, even in two generations, like that transformation that you feel so ready to support, you know, your kids if they ever needed them as well. So
yeah, I mean, it's truly, yeah, a generational story, right? From, yeah, my dad's 82, so.
And so on that note, we'll wrap up there. If people want to find you sharing your stories, but also sharing so many other people's, where can they find you online and your brilliant podcast?
All the Wiser is the name of the podcast, All the Wiser with Kimmy Culp. And you can find me wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen.
Brilliant. I love that. We'll wrap up there. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Bobby.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.